Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Health Tech Pigeon podcast, where we analyse the best health tech stories of the week every single week. I'm Hugh, and I'm delighted to be joined today for the first time on Health Tech Pigeon podcast by Ahuti, who's recently joined SOMX team on, I think we'll say it's a temporary basis, but, you know, we're really pleased to have you and for your debut appearance on the Health Tech Pigeon podcast. So we'll obviously have a bit of a back and forth on sort of, you know, how our weeks have been. But for the moment, would you just like to say a few words about yourself and introduce yourself to listeners? I'm sure most of them will know you better than they know SOMX. So please go ahead.
Thank you, Hugh. I'm absolutely delighted to be on the Health Tech Pigeon podcast, but also to be part of the SOMX team for a period of time. And my work in this space is generally with early to mid-stage startups, helping them figure out how to scale and succeed in their target markets with their innovations. And I'm also part of the development board of MQ Mental Health, which is a research charity in mental health, and a venture partner with Conduit Connect, which is an impact fund. So a few different things that I do in this space. And SOMX, well, I started my relationship with SOMX as a client, actually. I was, I think, in the first five clients that SOMX took on board back in the day, and have been a fan and a friend ever since.
Fantastic. Well, we're super pleased to have you on the Pigeon podcast for the first time, obviously. How has your week been? What have you been up to? I know you've been abroad for an exciting event.
Yeah, so the Women's Health Summit in Basel, that's where I was this week. First time at that particular Women's Health event. Quite different, actually. So quite a limited audience, you know, not one of these kind of massive conferences with multiple stages and big exhibition space. So nice, nicely curated, very intentional content, participants, speakers. I didn't know most of the people, which actually was kind of refreshing. I mean, I always love going to these things because it's a good chance to catch up, right, with people you haven't seen for a while. So it's always nice to see familiar faces. But actually, I hardly knew anyone there. Lots of new people, lots of new faces, really well represented in terms of different geographies as well. And a really intentional focus on policy, investment, and innovation. You know, it really felt like the team at Kisako Research, who organized this, had, you know, done a really good job in the lead up to this, being clear about what they want to achieve here and bringing the people together to make that happen. So it was really cool.
Wonderful, wonderful. It's interesting you say that, because, you know, we do go to a lot of events as a team, as an organization, and I think there's some wonderful events out there, particularly in the UK, but also abroad as well, where we're talking about a lot of, we sometimes find ourselves seeing the same people and talking about the same issues, and that's for obvious reasons. Those are the issues that matter to us, to us in the UK, to health systems and patients in the UK. But I'm interested. You said, you know, it's quite a broad mix of people and some interesting focus on policy. So, I mean, what were the topics being discussed? Were there any interesting things you'd like to share?
From a policy perspective, what was quite refreshing is, you know, we had perspectives from UK, Europe and the US. And it was quite an in-depth update, actually, on policy work that's being done around, you know, health economics in relation to women's health, initiatives that are in place to plug research gaps. But I think, you know, what made a difference is there was a good balance between, yes, there were the panel events, but some of these policy topics were actually subject matter experts, you know, leading this work that were given a 40-minute slot. So we got into some level of good detail around this. And there was quite a lot of thought leadership in the mix here as well, you know, when it came to sort of some of the policy session. So it wasn't really just an update on what's happening in those geographies when it comes to policy. These individuals actually stood up and, you know, gave their interpretation about women's health as a sector, and, you know, where it's travelled from and where it's travelling through and what else we kind of need to do and how that's informing policy and how that's informing some of the initiatives. So it just felt like this completely different level of detail. Mm. So I particularly liked that about it. I think there was some really good controversy as well. And, you know, like the panels were not rhetoric, you know, it wasn't just kind of all the same stuff. I think we got into some really good debates and disagreements. I posted about this actually, but the highlight for me was this kind of controversial moment where over the couple of days, there had been some quite unhelpful and disturbing narrative around menopause and, you know, the fact that we need innovations to delay the onset of menopause, and that would be an attractive area for investment. And 50% of the population are women, and, you know, a third of that population at any point in time are going through some kind of, you know, transition, and therefore we need to manage this. And, you know, it happened across the 2 days a few different times, and it culminated at the end of the second day in quite a heated 5 minutes where one particular individual, and she did a sterling job representing, I think, what most of us were sitting there thinking and feeling, is like, why do we want to delay the onset of menopause? And she went as far as to say, you know, like, she would always hire somebody that's postmenopausal because, you know, there's just this different air of capability and confidence that, you know, these women project once they've actually been through that transition. And, you know, anything that's trying to delay the onset of it is just rubbish and shouldn't be allowed. So, I mean, it was brilliant. So we had a few different moments like that throughout the 2 days where, you know, people weren't just staying in a safe space. I think that's the point. They weren't in just, you know, containing themselves. Oh, it's a conference, I'm on stage, or I'm putting my hand up to ask a question, I'm going to play this safe. I mean, there were some really good, candid, honest conversations that took place.
That's fantastic. I like an event where there's a bit of controversy. Overall, did the event feel like there was progress being made? You mentioned that, you know, there were actually people leading this research and talking about some of the gaps that exist. There's, at least in the UK, we've had the Women's Health Strategy, which obviously identified quite a lot of gaps in the research and put, like, closing them as a quite a focus. Does it feel like there is progress being made in that?
I think yes and no. I think what's progress is that there is sort of this widespread attention and focus on it, that there are strategies, there are policies. I don't think the funding is quite backing it up. So if we take the Women's Health Strategy here in the UK, you know, it's like a 10-year strategy, but with 2 years of funding. Mm. So, you know, great, we've achieved putting in place women's health hubs. Now, I think that in some cases, that's quite a grandiose name for something that's actually a part-time person sitting in a GP clinic that you can access if you manage to get an appointment, you know. But nevertheless, that is, I mean, it's still progress that there's a strategy. It's still progress that there's 2 years of funding. It's still progress that we have those hubs. But it's like a lot of stuff with healthcare policy, that it's too short-sighted. It's too, you know, kind of focused on the here and now. And, you know, we're just not doing enough long-term thinking. So I think some of the policy work, you know, that's being done by organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and, you know, some of the kind of NGOs, I think will carry more weight and actually is thinking long term. But then when that gets translated into government policy and healthcare plans and operational priorities, it whittles down to, well, we've got budget for this year, we've got budget for next year, and this is what we'll manage to do with that. So yes and no in terms of progress, always need more progress. And then I think the other area where I do feel we're making progress is the kind of spectrum of innovation in women's health. We had that kind of first few waves where it was really focused on self-management, tracking, you know, stuff that would appeal to consumers to buy out of, you know, self-pay out their own pocket stuff, and focused very much on, you know, areas and challenges which are really unique and specific to women's health, like fertility, menopause, etc. And now we're seeing at the other end of the spectrum some really kind of deep scientific biotech type development in women's health. And what I liked about the conference is that there was the whole spectrum, because we need progress across the whole spectrum. That's the point. And I think the first few waves, you know, picked off some of the low hanging fruit, almost, you know, some of the kind of more obvious stuff where we could kind of get it out to consumers, and they were no-brainer things to do, not to undermine that progress, of course, you know, really great developments at that time, but we need more than that. And that space is also getting crowded. So it's just as well, actually, that we're seeing more progress along the kind of more clinical and scientific end of the spectrum, where, you know, it was, you know, things like examples like, you know, using skin biomarkers to diagnose women's health conditions, using urine testing for breast cancer detection and screening. And those things are like fundamental game changers. You know, imagine how accessible, you know, breast screening becomes when it's not a mammogram unit in a Sainsbury's car park and it's, you know, urine test. And, you know, it just transforms the future of healthy populations, really. I mean, that's kind of how you get at it. So, yeah, really encouraged, actually. Really, really encouraged. Would have liked to see more investors there. I mean, you know, there was clearly an intention to have investors and to be talking about investment. And there was a lot of good content around it. But, you know, just probably a handful of investors, as far as I could see and tell from the agenda. And I didn't necessarily feel that they were very, you know, very much at the kind of forefront of the conversations. It kind of felt that if they weren't on the panels, then they were pretty silent when it came to being in the audience. So, yeah, I think, yeah, would have liked to see a bit more investors and them being more engaged, involved as well.
It's disappointing, isn't it? I mean, I've seen a lot of research, and we've featured a lot of research in Pigeon lately and white papers from, I mean, various quarters. I think Bill and Melinda Gates potentially released one very recently. McKinsey, Deloitte, they've all been doing sort of explorations, I guess, into the opportunity for investors, you know, the trillion dollar market that is women's health and the potential for it to be tapped. But it sounds like it, at least in this case, it might not be achieving quite the right effect, and there's still more work to do, which is, I hope we can close that gap very soon, because investors really do need to be in the room.
Yeah, I mean, they do. And, you know, and I think, like, just to kind of reaffirm that there's progress. It's just when your start point is much further back, you need that much more to happen in order to feel like real significant progress. So I think the collective efforts of anyone that's doing anything in women's health, you know, whether that's policy, investment, innovation, it's all progress. It's just, we need more of it. You know, we just need so much more and so much quicker when 50% of the population are women.
Completely. And on that note, it's on to our first story, which is probably another question of, you know, do we need more progress? So our first story comes to us from The Guardian Australia. What we're seeing is not telehealth. Alarm over doctors using AI and prescribing without seeing patients. So in Australia, regulators have been warned that... by consumer health representatives that essentially a lot there are a number of outlets that are prescribing medicine to patients without ever having seen the patient in person, without having had the opportunity to have that consultation and examine what their needs are and talk to them to decide exactly what their diagnosis is and make a prescription off the back of that. The demand on regulators is to decide whether this is a bad thing. Patients being offered medicine without ever having seen a doctor, particularly when it comes to a new condition or when it comes to a new medicine, could be concerning. So what we're seeing here is we're seeing the first real reaction against the use of AI to at least give diagnoses of conditions and be used by clinicians to not avoid seeing the patient, but definitely streamline some of the processes that get a patient, that streamline some of the processes that eventually see a patient prescribed with specific treatments. So Ahuti, you've taken a look at this. What are your thoughts on this? What are we seeing here? And is it something we need to be concerned with?
I think with any kind of progress, we end up discovering things that are blind spots that we hadn't kind of foreseen, certain situations happening. And then we quickly need to address that because it's no longer a blind spot. Now, I would have hoped and thought that from a clinical safety and in an industry that's so heavily regulated like healthcare, we wouldn't have been allowed to get into this position, you know, where we've got examples like this. What I think, however, and it's like, I guess, most journalism, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but, you know, I kind of feel like, you know, the article's a bit jumbled, you know, and it's whatever makes headlines, right? Like a lot of journalism. And I kind of feel like telehealth and AI have kind of been thrown up there in the headlines. Mm. And it's unhelpful. It's really unhelpful because actually, if you read the article and really spend time unpicking it, then it's actually not about telehealth and AI. Mm. So firstly, you know, 550 notifications have been submitted to this agency since July 2020, so almost 4 years, and only 30% of those relate to complaints about something being prescribed. So that's what, about 40, if my maths is right, that, you know, relate to complaints about a prescription being issued without a consultation. And then later on in the article, the examples that are given are like a subscription for vaping and, you know, there's sort of some other bits and pieces. And actually, it's not even, you know, the example that they give is actually a doctor who has a website which has the equivalent of a Google form. Mm-hmm. Where the patient puts in information and answers questions as they would if they were in a doctor's surgery answering questions. And then on the basis of that, a decision is made as to whether to prescribe the vape or not. Yeah. And that's not AI and that's not telehealth. And yet that's what's made the headlines. So what I find in a sector that's really struggling to get on its feet, but is much, much needed. I just feel quite strongly about this one that, you know, journalists need to take some responsibility and be careful about what gets thrown into the headlines, because it does paint a negative picture. And, you know, what we're therefore not looking at is all of those consultations that will have happened where things were safely prescribed. Now, do we need a protocol around this? Absolutely, yes. You know, if there is some loophole here and, you know, if there is something unsafe in the practice, even if it's one instance, right? In this case, there's about 40 instances, which is in 4 years, you know, not great. We shouldn't be having any unsafe instances. So, you know, is better practice required and better protocols required? Absolutely. But I just kind of feel that the article is, you know, creating a misperception here that it's actually about telehealth and AI. And really, it's not. I've got so much more to say on it. I'll pause there. As you can see, I felt quite passionate about this one.
No, I think it's interesting and it raises quite a few questions, doesn't it? I mean, there's that question of risk, isn't there? So, as you said, the $40 vape piece. We've got to be quite careful when we say that one thing being prescribed is you know, less risky than another thing being prescribed. But I think to a degree, you can definitely say prescribing the $40 vape is not the same as prescribing someone strong painkillers or something, you know, much more significant as part of their treatment. Equally, I very slightly disagree with you on the, it not being an AI piece, because I think it does beg the question of, do you need to see a person? Do you need to have a face-to-face conversation, whether you do it virtually or in person, in order to diagnose a patient? As you mentioned, the case that they've looked at specifically, Dr. Caroline Bowman states that her website, medicalnicotine.com.au, utilizes innovative proprietary AI to effectively achieve its aim. It's, as you said, it's basically a form. And much like many GP practices in the UK, at least in England and Wales, who are using very similar technology for that online access piece in order to triage patients. And, you know, we're in the UK, we're struggling so much with this whole, should primary care be an appointment first model? You know, doctors are so overstretched, the sector is struggling so much, and there are other ways of handling patients. There are other staff who can handle patients, and there are much more efficient ways to get people the care they need. And particularly with, you know, there's at least one model of that employed in the UK, which does use a form of algorithm in order to, at least when patients are entering their details into their online access form for their GP, does use a form of AI to structure that patient history taking process to take it from one end to the next, only capturing the relevant information. And it does have a really positive impact on whether, when the doctor get the triaging doctors come to look at the case to decide what do we do with this patient, they say, okay, well, I don't need to call the patient back to find out more info. I have as much info basically as if I'd asked those questions to them in an initial appointment. So I think for me, the question is, you know, I how far should we expect to see a doctor for everything if we can give them that information up front, or give them as much information as you would spend 10 minutes at an appointment, which most people tend to with their, you know, when speaking to a doctor these days. In that 10 minutes, if they're repeating all of these questions, repeating all of these pieces to you to get to that point where they can make that prescription, how much time have you wasted there? And can AI and can that progress just, you know, is this a progress where regulators need to get involved to make a difference, to make a change? Is there anything here that actually does need to be stopped? Or should we expect not to see a doctor each and every time we need something?
So I think actually, you know, what we're saying is this is a much broader issue, right? Mm. It's, you know, and again, the heading is, you know, I mean, let's put telehealth to one side, because whether you see somebody, you know, via Zoom call, have a phone call, see them in person, there are pros and cons of, you know, all of those methods. So I kind of feel like the telehealth aspect of this is a little bit of a red herring. The AI point, you know, whether it's a Google form or whether actually it is an algorithm, you know, and it's true AI that's driving some of these decisions around whether to prescribe and what to prescribe and how to triage the patient. I think it then just raises a question about how do we regulate the use of AI? How do we validate, you know, what is safe AI when an application, a solution says, well, we use an algorithm for this, you know, then it's the education and understanding and regulation that's needed around what is the AI, you know, AI is such an umbrella term. So what actually is the artificial intelligence and how does it work and how was it trained and how is it kept safe and how regulated? Is it updated and, right? I could go on with a list of another 10, 15 questions that we should be asking every company that claims to use AI in healthcare, that these are the questions that we should be fundamentally asking. So again, it's not about whether AI should and shouldn't be used. It's about what is the AI, how was it trained, and, you know, how is it being used? But even if we take it away from AI and telehealth, we've actually got non-digital issues, examples. We've got issues in circumstances and scenarios where actually there's no digital involved, but it's a similar kind of, there's parallels, right? There's parallels to, you know, the point of this article. There are parallels where it's not about telehealth and it's not about AI. So, you know, I'll give you two examples. One is repeat prescriptions, right? It's quite easy to get a repeat prescription, and you can get that through your NHS app now as well. And you can call the surgery. You can fill out a form through the surgery website. You can speak to the doctor next time you're there. Now, the difference, the obvious difference is the doctor would have had to have seen you the first time round before, you know, when they gave that prescription, and the doctor knows that you're on some kind of repeat prescription. But how often are medications reviewed for patients? You know, and some of the points in this article were like, well, what happens if a person has a bad reaction to a medication, or the practitioner who's doing the prescribing doesn't have their full history and understand what other medications that they're taking? You know, we have an issue with polypharmacy without telehealth and AI, and we have an issue around contraindications and medication reviews not being done regularly enough. And that's without telehealth and AI, right? So that's kind of one example. The other example, actually closer to home, is something I experienced, right? So we've all heard about the fact that GP access, improving GP access, all of these different initiatives, we're shifting kind of, as you said, Hugh, you know, does it have to be the GP? You know, other people can perhaps be that first point of contact, and pharmacists are increasingly becoming that first point of contact. Don't go to the GP surgery because pharmacists can now prescribe XYZ. You don't need to go to your doctor for this. Well, my pharmacist doesn't have my entire health record, and my pharmacist doesn't do any kind of consultation or physical examination on me when I go to them and ask them for something. And a recent example of this was 2 weeks ago. I had a god-awful flu, and day 3-4, I thought, do you know what, should probably get this checked out. Try to get a GP appointment. And the GP triage process, which was a form on a website, told me to go to the pharmacist because they can't offer an appointment for 3 days. So go to your pharmacist, because if you need antibiotics, the pharmacist can prescribe those. Now, the form didn't ask me for any information really about my different symptoms and blah, blah, blah. But the response was, go to the pharmacist and they can prescribe antibiotics. So somewhere in that triage process, there was a decision made that I'm okay to go to a pharmacist and I'm likely to need antibiotics. But I don't feel as a patient that I submitted enough information for that triage to have been done. Nevertheless, went off to my pharmacist and was met at the desk by an assistant. And I let her know that the GP's asked me to come to them instead because they can't offer me an appointment. And she said, okay, what seems to be the problem? So I started telling her the story with the first couple of symptoms that had, you know, appeared a week or so ago, which was my sore throat and a cough, at which point she said, oh, okay. And she ran off and spoke to the pharmacist. I saw them having a conversation for probably about 60 seconds, 90 seconds. She came back and she said, the pharmacist has advised that I sell you something called D-Flame, which is an over-the-counter product, and it will help you with your sore throat. And I said to her, but how do we know that there's nothing more here that needs to be addressed? And she said, well, it just sounds like it's just a sore throat and a bit of a cough. And the pharmacist said that do this for 3 days, and if it doesn't get better, then go and see your GP. And I thought, well, you know, on so many levels, that's just all flawed. But then I said, well, what about like a consultation? Like if I were to go to my GP, I would have had the GP listen to my chest. I would have had her look at my tonsils. I would have, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So how do we know that this isn't an infection? and that I don't need anything stronger and that I'm just not going to get worse in 3 days because this is unaddressed. And the pharmacist came over upon hearing this and kind of said, yeah, no, it doesn't sound like it. And I said, but I haven't told you all my symptoms. You haven't asked me all the questions, you know. So, yeah, I'll stop the story there. But suffice to say that, you know, I left without anything and was just told to take paracetamol for a few days and see how I got on. But the point here is I was triaged with very minimal information. You know, that triage suggested I might need antibiotics. I was sent to another healthcare professional who didn't do any consultation, who didn't ask any questions, who was going to sell me a throat spray. And in the end, I took paracetamol and, you know, 2 weeks later, I'm fine. It has so many parallels to what this article is challenging as well. And that was nothing to do with telehealth or AI.
First of all, that story is absolutely crazy. I mean, it really is, you know, I think. And what it just screams is that, it all comes down to risk, doesn't it? It all comes down to the assessment of risk. And at some point, someone has decided that based on, you know, the available workforce, based on the pressures on primary care and the potential risk of someone presenting with a cough, not being adequately triaged, being quite low, then we can send people to pharmacy who are less qualified, who won't take that. That there is an acceptable risk of us not offering you a GP appointment when you have those symptoms for us to be comfortable with. And it's the same as in this article. There is an acceptable risk for, presumably, I mean, the risk with particularly with AI and telehealth, it will always, well, I mean, particularly with AI and telehealth, but also with exactly that scenario you described, what we're talking about is essentially the risk will always sit with the clinician that you engage with, the triaging clinician if you go to your GP or try to access primary care in that way and they send you to a pharmacist. I almost feel like your scenario is even worse in its own way because, you know, the risk of not triaging you properly, not taking that comprehensive medical history before sending you to the pharmacist, and absolutely no slight on pharmacists here, you know, it's a high pressure workforce and obviously things are changing very quickly, but the risk of not having you go through primary care before determining that piece and just immediately referring you, someone must have decided that is an acceptable thing and it will be one that patients face daily in their hundreds of thousands. So I think, honestly, there is that question, even before you get to telehealth, even before you get to AI, are clinicians accepting an overall too high level of risk in the current system? And I think I'm sure many would turn on me right now and say that's a policy problem that needs solving rather than an individual clinician problem that needs solving. But I think it does raise some questions.
And it really kind of highlights the increased risk around data silos and fragmentation, right? Because had I gone to the GP surgery, even if I hadn't seen the GP, there would have been something on my record which showed that I had a visit, these were the symptoms, this was what was recommended and discussed. And actually my interaction there at the pharmacy on the high street has just gone completely unrecorded and unnoted. And yes, I didn't take any medication, but my health record is not just about my medications. You know, it's about a longitudinal picture of my health over time. And that interaction has completely got missed. Now, I use Patient Knows Best. So of course I put an entry into my app to say that that's kind of what I did and what the symptoms were. But and I'm okay as a, you know, I'm happy to own my health and do stuff like that. But, you know, I kind of feel that we're still at a stage where the National Health Service owns our health data and has our records. And yet here's an important, what I consider to be an important part of my health journey, where there's just no record.
It's something we need to fix and solve. And I know not everyone has access to Patients Know Best either. So I think we're definitely going to end up with a postcode lottery, not just in terms of access to these services, but also people's ability to manage their own health And also people's confidence too as well. So one to watch and one for potentially regulators to have a look at. So our next story comes to us from MedCity News. A wearable tech gives farmers and therapists better feel for changes in mental health. Now, as we go into this, we'll realise that that headline is also a pun. So a company called Feel Therapeutics believes it has cracked the mental health code with using biomarkers and various other indications to understand exactly how you're feeling and exactly what your mental health state is. Because as far as this company believes, we're in a place where ultimately therapists cannot get a 100% accurate picture of how you're feeling. According to this company's founder, people are inherently bad at saying how they feel or describing their current mental health state. People are bad storytellers and they're not good at reporting. Self-reporting is not always accurate, and as such, poor mental health can go undiagnosed. This new wearable from Feel Therapeutics is claims to be able to use all of the various indicators such as your heart rate, how much you're sweating, and various other biomarkers across your body to be able to determine that and report back to pharma companies and therapists to give them a more accurate picture. So Ahuti, you've had a look at this and you had some thoughts. What are your views on this? What sounds good? What sounds less good?
I always get excited about developments in mental health, right? So I've been a volunteer mental health advocate and helped people on their journeys with their mental health. And that has given me so many insights on a day-to-day basis around what it's like to live with, deal with, manage, and, you know, have mental health conditions treated. So whenever I see some developments in mental health, I double click quickly to read what it's all about. And this headline really did catch my eye because I think it's spot on that mental health is probably one of the few conditions where we don't have any objective data. And there's a huge amount of innovation in mental health around this, right? Using voice technology, using ocular biomarkers. So we're getting much, much better at having digital biomarkers tell us the state of our mental health. And it's huge, huge progress. So for that reason, as a headline, I thought, great. And another one where we're making mental health assessment and understanding more objective. So really like that. And this one, looks at skin temperature, sweat, heart rate. So it's looking at a lot of different parameters and then drawing some, conclusions. So I guess it's probably some kind of an index, based on all of those different parameters that tells you something. I think there's a lot yet left open to interpretation in this one. And again, sadly, sorry, journalist, but the article was just incredibly jumbled up, so I really couldn't make sense of it. So I think, firstly, this product, this solution is positioned in four or five different ways in the article. And it's really difficult to tell that what actually is it there for? Is it something that's being used in clinical trials to monitor the mental state of people when they're taking behavioral medication? Is it to help analyze emotional states of people or mental health states of people on a day-to-day basis so that we can really kind of address things at a more kind of day-to-day practical level, like do a breathing exercise, you seem stressed, do some journaling because of this, or is it actually about managing the anxiety and depression that's associated with ADHD, which is also something that was mentioned in the article? But all of this was mentioned in the article. And I'm like, so what is this solution? When they developed it, what was the intended use case? And is this a situation of a company that's developed something and just kind of keeps pivoting to try and find the product market fit? So I'm less enthusiastic about you know, the kind of measure my emotional state and tell me to do something in that moment, because really that's just about emotions, and emotions are impermanent, you know, like they pass. That's just the nature of emotions, and not to say that you shouldn't be in tune with that and respond to that, but you know, I'm really intrigued that if this is what this tool is about, then to what end, you know, like what are, you know, some of the health outcomes by intervening on this kind of micro moment basis, because my heart rate variability has suddenly changed, or I'm slightly hotter. I don't know how they deal with that for menopausal women, because, you know, we're going to be hotter. So, you know, that kind of stuff was going on in my mind for that sort of a use case. The study, I had a look at the actual paper that was published, really tiny study, actually. Mm. So I think a heck of a lot more needs to be done, because it was a single arm study. And on top of that, it was a companion solution to the 30 people actually receiving other forms of treatment for anxiety, depression, and this was a cohort of people with ADHD. Mm. And whilst the outcomes that were reported were beneficial, like as in people's anxiety and depression seem to have got better, how do we know how much of that can be attributed to this versus the actual talking therapy, the CBT, etc., that they were also receiving as a direct treatment approach for those 30 individuals, because there wasn't another arm of the study where there were some people that weren't using this kind of digital solution. So, you know, I'm quite surprised again that we're kind of talking about this. Not that we are, but as in like it's kind of, you know, made it into sort of some news here, and that it's still such a confusing jumbled story as to what is this, and exactly where is the progress here. So that's a slightly, perhaps slightly harsh view, but mental health is so underfunded, so under-researched, needs a heck of a lot more attention. And I just, and there's a lot of noise in this space. There are so many solutions for mental health, and I just, anything that kind of adds to the noise, you know, slightly worries me, because we don't need more noise in this space.
You're absolutely right. It's, I think it's a lot of bold claims being made in this, or at least bold and very broad pitch, as you say. You know, what are they trying to go with? And based on such a small study, such a niche study, 30 patients with ADHD, it's, and I, you know, I'm very interested to see where, you know, with the platform, along with reductions in depressive and anxiety symptoms, I'm assuming that those were clinically measured depressive and anxiety symptoms, not just lower heart rates and less sweating based on the platform. It is interesting. I think some of the indicators that they're talking about, skin temperature, sweat, heart rate, but also, you know, are you moving? Are you interacting with other devices that are both of which are apparently indicators of behavioral changes that could be in this? Yeah, there's some big claims made, and there's definitely not quite enough yet to back them up. I'd like to believe that there definitely is. They're also not the first in this space. A company called Matter, that received quite a bit of coverage for their raise, I think last month, claimed to have identified the 6 biomarkers of happiness, which, again, very interesting story, and absolutely worth looking them up and having a look at their deck as well, because they explain exactly what they think of the 6 biomarkers. Again, no reference to data in that deck, if I can recall, but there is a lot going on. You're right. Is there, you know, is it good to see? I mean, you say, you know, what we don't want is more noise, but is it good to see people trying on this, or do we need them to go away and come back when they've got that data?
Look, you know, this is the space of innovation. So we have to try stuff, and, you know, we have to do studies, whatever we can afford to do, and test things out, because from that we realize what the bigger study has to address. And so, you know, all of this is progress, and it's what innovation is, right? Where we try some stuff out. I think what we just have to be careful about is how we report back, We are all bombarded with so much information on a day-to-day basis, and it just doesn't, it's not helpful when things are not well considered, thought out, structured, put across, because it just adds to misperceptions, confusions, false claims. You know, investment gets channeled in the wrong places on the back of some of this. So I think it's just more a case of, you know, let's just get really, let's be entrepreneurial, innovative, you know, and have these kind of maverick approaches to wacky ideas and things that we want to try out. But then when it comes to actually the rigor and the discipline about what we have understood and established, let's kind of get really clear about what that is, because otherwise it does just add to information overload and noise, and it's just hard to see the wood for the trees and really focus on those innovations that are fundamentally going to make a difference. I was excited by this headline because I thought, wow, yes, mental health is too subjective. You know, diabetes, we have CGMs, we have blood pressure cuffs, we have this, that, and the other for all these other conditions. Mental health needs objective data measurement. But you kind of lift the lid and, you know, it's not necessarily that, but it could be that. Again, it's just not clear. So clarity is really important. It builds trust. And, you know, we really need to build trust in this space.
So our final story comes to us from Sifted's Kai Nicole Schwartz. Health Tech Zoe announces 20% cost cutting detailing redundancy packages. So this is UK gut health startup Zoe, which, as the article says, is one of Europe's best funded direct to consumer health techs. Once called the fastest growing health tech by headcount in the UK, has announced that it needs to reduce its costs by 20%. CEO and co-founder Jonathan Wolf put out a statement to employees earlier this week saying that unfortunately the company had overexpanded, that it had grown too fast, and that in order to be sustainable, it needed to make cuts. And that included a number of its workforce as well, which is obviously tragic news. We wish them the best with their next opportunity. And I think there's a lot in this. And it's not, I don't think it's all about Zoe itself, because quite a lot of the interesting points that Jonathan Wolf pulled out in his piece when talking about the company raise wider questions, for me at least, about subscription health models, well, consumer subscription health models in particular. Jonathan Wolf said that despite having gained 100,000 members in 2023 alone and having had a peak membership of 4.7 million, that the company's churn rate was higher than expected, and in fact the average member stayed for between 6 and 9 months, which for me is surprising. I think it says a lot, not about Zoe. I know there's been a lot of press about Zoe and a lot of coverage, both good and bad, over the last 6 months, about their model and gut health generally and consumer health more widely, but that adherence rate, that retention rate, is really quite surprising to me as such a popular app with such credibility in the market. So Ahuti, you've taken a look at this one as well. Yeah, what are your thoughts on this? There's some surprising stats in there.
Yeah, I mean there is and there isn't, you know. So I'm really interested in this one and read it and thought about it quite a bit. I've been a customer of Zoe, and I was probably one of those numbers that dropped off as well. So, you know, I think there's a lot of lessons here that you can kind of extrapolate. And as you said, Hugh, totally agree with you that this is not actually just about Zoe, but because having been a customer, actually, it's quite obvious to me why they've got this problem. So if anyone from Zoe is listening, really happy to come and help you address this, by the way, because it's actually, you go through this as a customer and it becomes glaringly obvious what goes wrong where, and, you know, why retention and engagement is such an issue. But I think if we kind of zoom out, I think you're spot on that, you know, here's a company that scaled quick with a D2C model. They benefited almost from a perfect storm because during COVID times, you know, they became quite high profile because of their origins and the science and, you know, Tim Spector being a co-founder and all of, you know, they were really good as a business to respond to the situation we found ourselves in and use their platform to actually fulfill quite an important function, which was missing at the time because, you know, the government were kind of struggling to keep up to date with what are the symptoms of COVID. And, you know, here was Zoe with all of these hundred thousands of people logging their symptoms and they were building up quite an accurate picture. But of course, you know, that passed and the company had to kind of refocus and repivot onto what it originally set out to do once we passed through that. But I think that period of time really helped Zoe become high profile. And, you know, a lot of people kind of subscribed to them, downloaded the app and were engaged with them. So I think I see this actually with a lot of companies, even if they're not D2C, that what happens as a company kind of grows, they get their product market fit, you know, and then they think it's just a question of scaling that. So they start hiring the people that's needed. They start putting money into more bells and whistles in terms of the product. But all the time, they're actually in the real world and they're starting to kind of, you know, and that real world is a shifting marketplace. You know, they're getting like criticisms from this real world. They're understanding how people are engaging, not engaging in this real world. And that marketplace is changing and new products and solutions are emerging and the needs of the population are changing and economic situation is changing and people can't afford things. You know, all of that is shifting. And what I tend to find with, you know, companies like Zoe that have got through that initial barrier and those initial challenges, you know, suddenly like it's almost like they forget to keep reevaluating who they are as a business and what their proposition is and whether they, you know, whether it's product market fit. So, you know, if the market is changing, the product needs to be continually thought about, not in terms of new bells and whistles and just what existing users are asking for, but, you know, just a zoom out of what that market is and therefore what the product needs to be to, in order to continue with that product market fit. The other thing I find interesting about this is in the article, they declare that most of their cost base is really made up of salaries. So somewhere the unit economics of a tech company have gone wrong, right? Because tech companies, subscription models, SaaS, all of that, you know, the attraction here is about the unit economics. As you scale, you become more profitable. Well, in order to scale, you know, if their cost base, you know, has gone up with the number of people and, you know, the warehouses and all the rest of it, in order to fulfill that, somewhere their unit economic thinking is flawed, because for a tech business as a subscription model that's SaaS based, it, you know, that's just not how it should be scaling. So somewhere inefficiencies have come in, or their fundamental operating model needs looking at. But I think, you know, just coming back to sort of the customer viewpoint on this, I'm really not surprised about the 6 to 9 months cliff edge, because most of the value you're going to derive has been derived, and then it becomes super expensive to maintain after that, because it's a law of diminishing returns almost. It's a classic situation where you just don't really get anything more and anything new, so why would you continue? So really, really not surprised about that. So there's something about, you know, them as a business, I think, needing to, you know, almost think like a startup again, like one of those early stage startups, and think, you know, who are we? What are we? What's the market become? What do we learn from all of this real world feedback and the criticisms? You know, because they've been in the press with some pretty controversial stuff as well around how they're not kind of really helping people with eating disorders and people that have got chronic conditions. You know, this this isn't necessarily accurate and appropriate advice for them. So really, is it personalized nutrition? You know, from a physiological, biological perspective, maybe, because they look at your gut microbiome and they look at your fat digestion and your blood glucose, you know, your that kind of ability that your body has for all of those aspects. But they're not necessarily considering other conditions that you may have. And when the majority of the population has at least one chronic condition, if you're going to take an approach to personalized nutrition, that has to play a part in it.
So you raise a couple of really good points there from the Texas consumer point of view, where, you know, that you're not surprised at that retention rate. I'm interested, do you think survival for them is going back to the drawing board and thinking not just what we offer customers on day one through, you know, day 100, but what do we offer customers at year three? What is it that we are continually giving? What is the continuing value of this product to users? And then from that specialist point of view, you know, it doesn't necessarily help if you've got specific conditions. It's of less value in those cases. Have they missed the boat? You know, if you have a specific condition, I think, you know, at least one story in every Pigeon newsletter is about a new app or solution to help you manage a certain condition. You're probably not going to choose Zoe for that when there's a more specialist app that's designed specifically for what you're living with, if that's something a bit more chronic or a bit more specialist to work through.
Yeah, I mean, what you say there raises a couple of different thoughts in my mind. I think the problem is that in the space of nutrition and chronic condition, there's still a lot more science and research that we need around, you know, what does nutrition look like if you've got this condition or that condition? And some of those gaps are being plugged. You know, if you look at anything to do with IMIDs, so immune-mediated inflammatory conditions, there's, you know, some science and research now around how to manage inflammation and through your diet, and therefore that kind of helps you manage your condition. So I think it's a case that we just don't know. So maybe Zoe can help with certain chronic conditions and it can't help with others. But without knowing which ones it can and can't, it leaves people in a place of uncertainty, and it leaves their clinical teams in a place where they're going to perhaps be slightly cynical. One, because they perhaps don't know what principles and science Zoe is based on, and therefore if I am a patient with inflammatory bowel disease and I go to see my gastroenterologist once every 3 months and I say, well, I'm following this advice, you know, I would fully expect for that gastroenterologist to be a little bit alarmed because they don't perhaps understand Zoe, they don't know what advice Zoe is giving to me, they don't know if it's tailored to me. So I think there's that aspect of it that came to mind when you said what you just said earlier. The second thing, you're right, that, you know, there are these kind of condition specific apps. And the thing that I would say about Zoe, which is a real plus, but it, on the flip side, it's also perhaps a little bit of a negative for them, is that they are very technical about their approach, you know, in terms of the science and how, what they test for, how they test for it, how they recommend the different food types for you. There's actually so much detail that it's quite overwhelming. And if you are living with a condition and you're trying to manage all different aspects of that condition, your medications, your exercise, your mental health, you know, your diet, then Zoe in that context can perhaps feel quite disempowering because there's actually too much detail and so much information that Zoe puts your way. How to actually incorporate that from a behavioral change perspective in your day-to-day living is quite a challenge. And I wonder actually whether they're just too sophisticated for the majority of the population. Now, their price point probably reflects that level of sophistication and detail that they provide. But is everyone going to appreciate that level of detail? Does everyone need that when actually I believe the majority of the population, you know, just kind of needs to readdress the balance in their diet, you know, and do a bit more exercise and will actually have much better health outcomes, you know, from a population perspective? Do we all need that level of detail? You know, is that more disabling than it is helpful? And therefore, should they actually be looking at a much more basic entry level product? You know, that then you can kind of layer on some additional features and functionality for the people that then, you know, want to take it further because they're seeing benefit or because they can, they have the financial means, they don't have these other chronic conditions that need to play in. You know, there's a lot that Zoe can still do. I hope they find a way through this because I actually think they've got some, you know, important science that they've developed around this. But I do think their business thinking has become flawed along the way.
We could get to the end of this and then someone tells us that it was genuinely just cost of living that made them in a target. As you say, you know, the subscription model, I'm not personally a member of Zoe, but I know that I've been looking at all of my subscriptions and thinking, what can I cut back? And I can imagine something like this being a luxury that a lot of people are not going to be able to afford. So maybe that sort of more entry-level product that gives just that core value proposition, whatever that might may be, could be a smart move in the future. Wonderful. Thanks, Ahuti. It was a great conversation. Really enjoyed that. So I think all that's left to say is you can find all of the news stories we've discussed today and more at healthtechpigeon.com, along with some of the best jobs, events, and opportunities in health tech. We'll be back next week. See you then.